Welcome to Managing Acute Myeloid Leukemia, or AML. I am Dr. Hetty Carraway, and today I will review whether IDH2 inhibitors are right for your AML patient. During the course of this presentation, I will review the prognosis for adult patients diagnosed with AML, summarize the role of IDH2 inhibitors in the diagnosis, prognosis, and treatment of patients with IDH2-mutated AML, outline a treatment plan for AML patients with IDH2 mutation in the relapsed or refractory setting, taking into consideration patient selection, proper administration, and potential adverse events, as well as identify the latest updates on emerging data related to safety and efficacy of IDH2 inhibitors currently in clinical trials. These are my disclosures. As you all know, AML affects about 21,000 patients annually. Unfortunately, over 50% of those patients die directly from acute myeloid leukemia. The diagnosis of AML is uncommon before the age of 45, and the average age at diagnosis is 68. It is slightly more common among men than women. And as you all know, the majority of adults with AML achieving complete remission will ultimately relapse, and a minority of such patients are cured. The prognostic factors in treating patients with AML include age, cytogenetics, mutational status, as well as the duration of their complete remission, their first complete remission. Here you can see AML in the old and young patients and the incidence related to their age. Young patients are typically defined under the age of 60, and older patients are usually defined as greater than or equal to the age of 60. You can see here the blue bars reflect incidence in males, and red bars or orange bars reflect incidence in females. In general, you can see a spike in the incidence after the age of 60, which annotates the typical population for patients diagnosed with AML. A typical treatment approach to AML before 2017 included evaluating patients and separating them into a population that would be able to undergo therapy with induction chemotherapy, such as 7 and 3, cytarabine plus an anthracycline. And for those patients undergoing intensive chemotherapy, we would stratify those patients based on their chromosome and mutational status as to whether or not they were favorable, intermediate, or unfavorable. For those patients highest at risk, if they were appropriate for bone marrow transplant, those patients in the intermediate and unfavorable category would then receive consolidation with a transplant, whereas those in the favorable or intermediate category that were not transplant candidates or not needing transplant, they would receive consolidation chemotherapy with cytarabine. Furthermore, those patients that were not able to tolerate induction chemotherapy typically proceeded with hypomethylating therapy, low-dose cytarabine, or supportive care. As noted here, many of the patients were, again, risk stratified based on age, cytogenetics, molecular analysis, including the mutations annotated on the slide. When we think about our patients that are older, over the age of 60, as we previously discussed in the prior slide, you can see the complete remission rates for that population pale in comparison to those that are younger, to the tune of 40 to 55% CR rates compared to 65 to 85% CRs. Additionally, treatment-related mortality is higher in the older adults, ranging 15 to 25%. And you can see ultimately 5-year overall survival for those patients that are older is in typical single digits. These data highlight the fact that our older patients really do not do well. Additionally, when we look over the last 40 years, you can see here that survival has improved for AML patients under the age of 60. As annotated by the figure, you can see the percentage of patients surviving in the newest timeline, in the pink line on the top, 2004 to 2009, 47% survival for patients age 15 to 59, compared to 20% survival for those patients that are over the age of 60. Thus, over the last 40 years, survival has improved for AML patients under the age of 60, and little progress has been made for the long-term survival for patients over the age of 60. In 2017, it was highlighted by approvals. Historical perspective annotated here kind of shows you how long it took for novel agents to be approved for patients diagnosed with AML. And 2017 was a pretty fantastic year for novel agents emerging for patients with a diagnosis of AML. You can see in 1970 that 7 in 3 was found to bring on complete remission rates in patients with AML. Transplant came on the scene in 1980s. Gemtuzumab was approved in 2000, then came off the market 10 years later. And then furthermore, when we think about what happened in 2017, midostaurin was approved for newly diagnosed FLT3 mutated acute myeloid leukemia patients. In addition, enasidenib was approved for relapsed refractory IDH2 mutations, mutated positive patients with AML. CPX351 was also approved for newly diagnosed therapy-related AML or AML with MDS-related changes. And Mylotarg or gemtuzumab ozogamicin for newly diagnosed CD33 AML patients in the relapsed refractory CD33 positive AML was also approved. During this talk, we will focus specifically on enasidenib for relapsed refractory IDH2 mutated positive patients with AML. Let's jump to a case to lead off the discussion. This is a 69-year-old female who presents with a significant past medical history of IDH2 and DNMT3A positive AML. She has a normal karyotype for which she was treated with induction 7-in-3 2 months ago. She has a new onset of fevers and flu-like symptoms. Unfortunately, her CBC reveals a white count that's elevated at 32,000 with 68% circulating blasts. A bone marrow biopsy confirms relapsed AML with blasts expressing MPO, CD13, CD33, and CD117. Repeat molecular studies confirm an IDH2 positive status. She has an ECOG performance status of 2 and would like to get therapy, but she tells you she'd prefer to be home rather than hospitalized for that therapy. Based on this case, the best option for this patient who desires outpatient-based therapy includes A, induction with cytarabine and daunorubicin, B, low-dose cytarabine, C, enasidenib, 100 milligrams PO QD, D, oral etoposide, or E, best supportive care with transfusions and antibiotics. And I would say at this point that we'll highlight the selection that I think is the answer here, enasidenib, 100 milligrams PO QD, and we'll talk a little bit more about why that's the case. We do know that isocitrate dehydrogenase 2 or IDH2 mutations exist in patients with AML, and we know that the presence of these mutations confer a gain of function resulting in conversion of alpha-ketoglutarate to 2-hydroxyglutarate. These IDH enzymes are critical enzymes of the citric acid cycle, and they do convert isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate. What happens in the mutated state when IDH2 is mutated, you can see that, as we just discussed, isocitrate is converted to alpha-ketoglutarate with IDH2. And in the mutated state, you can see alpha-ketoglutarate becomes 2-hydroxyglutarate. And the presence of this 2-hydroxyglutarate alters DNA methylation and blocks cellular differentiation. And there can be an accumulation of 2-hydroxyglutarate when patients have a mutated IDH2 positive state. We also know that mutated IDH2 exists or is positive in about 8 to 19% of patients diagnosed with AML. Enasidenib, or AG221, or CC90007, is a selective oral potent inhibitor of mutated IDH2 enzyme, and its safety and efficacy was evaluated in an open-label, single-arm, multicenter phase 1-2 dose escalation and expansion study in adults with relapsed refractory AML that had a positive IDH2 mutation. Most patients in the study received 100 milligrams a day, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the subsets in that larger study, specifically focusing on those patients that only received 100 milligrams a day. You'll see that in the upcoming slides. The efficacy of this agent was established on the basis of rate of complete response with hematologic recovery, or CRH, and duration of response, and duration of response was defined as time since first response of CR or CRH to relapse or death, as well as rate of conversion from transfusion-dependent to transfusion-independent. You can see here the baseline demographic and disease characteristics for those AML patients treated with 100 milligrams a day of enasidenib. You can see the median age for those patients was 68 years of age. And again, this population included those patients that were only given 100 milligrams a day. The study itself had a larger cohort of patients, and you'll see that in upcoming slides. But here we're really specifically focused on the 99 patients that were relapsed refractory and received only 100 milligrams of enasidenib. You can see by and large, many patients had an ECOG performance status of 1 or 2. You can see that annotated as greater than or equal to 1. 76% of the patients fit into that category. The majority of patients, 78% of patients, had an IDH mutation at R140 compared to R172, and you'll see in the upcoming slides why I'm pointing that out. A small percentage of patients had a prior bone marrow transplant, and you can see here annotated in the cytogenetic risk, many patients had intermediate or poor risk cytogenetics, 49% and 27% respectively. The majority of patients were transfusion dependent at baseline, and again, lots of patients, 55% of patients had greater than or equal to 2 prior anti-cancer regimens for their AML. When we look at the investigator-reported responses among AML patients treated with enasidenib, you can see here what I was talking about or referring to on the earlier slides, where we have the larger population relapsed refractory AML, and we have the cohort of enasidenib that was treated only with 100 milligrams a day. And there, because this was a dose escalation study, there were other patients, 176 patients, that were treated with doses up to and including, I think, 600 or 600 milligrams a day. You can see, as we look at overall response rate here annotated in the 100 milligrams per day arm, 38.5%, compared to all doses, 40.3%. The CR rate in the 100 milligram per day dose was 20.2%, and similar to all doses, 19.3%. CR with incomplete platelet recovery was 6.4%, and partial remission, 2.8%, and morphologic leukemia-free state, 9.2%, with similar percentages in the all-dose cohort. Furthermore, I think it is important to pay attention to the fact that there is some evidence of stabilization of disease annotated here at 53% in the 100 milligram per day cohort and closer to 48% in the all doses cohort. There was about 5% of patients that had progressive disease and about 2% of patients that were not evaluable. Importantly, we'll talk about this in the upcoming slides, looking at the time to first response, duration of response, and time to complete remission. And we'll talk a little bit more about these details in upcoming slides. Again, for this cohort, you can see the median follow-up was about 6.6 months. And again, just to highlight, in the 100 milligram per day cohort, 19% achieved a complete remission and 4% achieved a complete remission with partial hematologic response. The overall response was 40.3%, and 87.3% of responding patients attained their first response by cycle 5. And what that means is 5 months in, 87% had their first response by that duration of time. Importantly, median time to first response is 1.9 months, and median duration of response was 8.2 to 9.6 months. You can see annotated here the overall survival for relapsed refractory AML patients on enasidenib. The blue line highlights those patients that achieved a complete response, and you can see the median overall survival for that cohort was 19.7 months. And for those patients that had no response is the green line here with a median overall survival of 7 months. Again, when we were discussing some of the stable disease, there are patients that have a non-CR response with a median overall survival of 13.8 months. One of the reasons why I particularly liked this graph, this describes and demonstrates better the evolution of response during treatment of responding patients. So these are all patients that have some type of response, whether it's a CR, or a PR, or even stabilization of disease. The CR represents the red boxes, and you can see here that the CRs do have by treatment cycle 7, you can see the highest number of patients around the 7th cycle, which then falls off by cycle 19, very similar to the data that we just walked through in terms of median time to response. You do see that there's a large bar for stabilization of disease that also falls off with some period of time. So this graph is a nice pictorial of the data that we just walked through, but is a nice visual to kind of keep in your mind's eye. So what happens to our patients that are on this particular therapy, and what are the things that we should look out for? Here we see annotated the treatment-related adverse events that are greater than or equal to grade 3 or 4, and these were annotated by occurring in greater than or equal to 2% of all patients that were on therapy. Again, highlighted here are those patients that received 100 milligrams a day compared to all of the patients. And the things that I want you to remember are that patients can have hyperbilirubinemia, and here it's annotated to 8% of the population that was receiving 100 milligrams a day. Patients that do have hyperbilirubinemia, we think that it's related to the UGT1A1 system and the way that the drug is metabolized, and many of the patients that have a high bilirubin do not have elevations of other liver function tests like AST, ALT, and ALK-FOS, and in that setting, they were able to stay on the agent and did not need a dose reduction or a dose interruption. Furthermore, that the things that we'll talk about in the upcoming slides are the differentiation syndrome that you see here, listed as IDH differentiation syndrome in 7% of patients, and we'll talk more a little bit about that. There are patients that have anemia, thrombocytopenia, tumor lysis syndrome, as well as some issues with fatigue, nausea, but pretty minimal in terms of single-digit numbers. The thing that I would like to point out is there are some percentage of patients that have an increase in their white count, and that typically is managed by initiating hydrea and following their counts and making sure that their white count stays below 20,000. I have fielded questions from other colleagues and patients. Are the patients that are having a high white count or differentiation syndrome more likely to be responding to the agent? And there does not appear to be a correlation between those two entities in terms of adverse event and responses. What I do want to drive home is that there is evidence of differentiation with targeted IDH2 inhibition, and there is a black box warning that you should be aware of and knowledgeable about, which is differentiation syndrome with enasidenib. This is an entity that can be fatal if it's not treated, and it can happen anywhere from 10 days to 5 months from the start of therapy. Depicted here, you can see at screening a predominance of blasts, 37% blasts, shown in this figure here from a slide of a patient's bone marrow. And by day 15, you can see evidence of cellular differentiation. And then cycle 3, day 1, you can see a decrease in the percentage of blasts and further differentiation with neutrophils and other differentiated cells. For those patients that have differentiation syndrome, they typically will present with symptoms such as fever, dyspnea, acute respiratory distress, pulmonary infiltrates, pleural pericardial effusions, bone pain, or other multi-organ dysfunction, whether it's hepatic or renal or multi-organ. The treatment for these patients is to administer systemic corticosteroids and begin hemodynamic monitoring. If patients do not get better after 48 hours with regard to the differentiation syndrome, instructions with regard to stopping the enasidenib if the symptoms do not improve or if the patients end up having true issues and respiratory distress and needing ventilator support. There's more information, of course, that we can provide with regard to that. One of the things that I alluded to earlier is I've fielded lots of questions about whether or not patients that have differentiation syndrome, are they more likely to be the responders to this drug? And you can see here the response among patients with and without IDH differentiation syndrome. Here's 33 patients with differentiation syndrome compared to those patients without differentiation syndrome. And this was reviewed by Dr. Fathi and presented in JAMA. Beginning of this year, and you can see that there were overall equal overall responses, 45% versus 37% with equivalent CR rates, 18% versus 19%, as well as CRI-CRP. So ultimately, they're really the conclusion of this investigation was that there were no differences in clinical responses based on the presence or absence of IDH differentiation syndrome. Other questions might be, does the site of the IDH2 mutation matter, and can we predict those patients that are going to be responders? As we talked about earlier, the majority of patients have an IDH mutation located at R140, and the overall response rate for those patients was 35% with a CR rate of 17.7%. And patients with the IDH2 mutation located at R172 had an overall response rate of 53.3% and a CR rate of 24.4%. Ultimately, it was evaluated and it was determined that there were not differences in real terms for patients with R140 versus R172. Although, it does seem that there appears to be somewhat of an improved overall response rate, but those patients with R172 really are much less frequent than those with R140. Furthermore, as I discussed earlier, we do have an accumulation of 2-hydroxyglutarate. So you could imagine measuring the suppression of 2-hydroxyglutarate as a correlate. Interestingly, the extent of 2-hydroxyglutarate suppression from baseline at cycle 2, day 1, was not correlated with clinical responses among all patients or within either site mutation group. And, you know, again, we did talk about some of the data for all the other doses that were included in this dose escalation study, and clinical activity was observed at all enasidenib doses from 50 milligrams to 650 milligrams once a day. Ultimately, we would love for all of our patients to respond to targeted therapy. So, of course, we're talking about how can we improve therapy. I think there was some interesting work presented at ASH looking at how does IDH2 positive AML relapse despite the targeted therapy, and understanding the mechanisms of resistance, you know, may help us to target those patients that aren't responding or lose response. So Quek et al. Annotated the clonal evolution at the time of relapse in those patients with IDH2 mutated AML treated with enasidenib. And this work demonstrated that at relapse, there were no new IDH2 mutations at new IDH sites, as we typically see in patients that have BCR-ABL or FLT3 mutations, but rather acquired additional mutations that highlight bypass pathways, which reimpose a differentiation or arrest. So, for example, there may be an acquisition of an IDH1 mutation and result in an increase in 2-hydroxyglutarate, or a deletion of chromosome 7, or a gain-of-function mutation that results in cell proliferation like FLT3 or CSF3R, and other mechanisms. And I think further work is ongoing to see if there are new mutations that occur in the IDH2 and IDH1 space, and more work is ongoing with that, and I expect to hear more in this upcoming year. Furthermore, we'll hear more as well about clonal progression and how best to sequence the agents and or combine them to eradicate the mother clone. And we'll talk more about the ongoing studies that we're eager to hear results on, which is this, where I just wanted to highlight what are the other studies that are going on, not only using enasidenib as a single agent, but potentially combining it with chemotherapy agents. So, for example, azacitidine plus enasidenib is ongoing in the upfront IDH2 positive AML. In this study led by DiNardo et al., decitabine fell off due to a Bayesian design, and there's promising response rates, but we await durability. Additionally, induction chemotherapy plus enasidenib in the upfront IDH2 positive AML mutated population really adds the early introduction of enasidenib in the upfront 7-3 setting. It is unclear if this will be synergistic early versus late, primarily because when cells harbor this IDH mutation, we know that it means that those cells have an impaired response to DNA damage. And if we give the inhibitor to eradicate this mutation, it may decrease the chemotherapy effect on the leukemia cell. But this is yet to be seen. We really do not know what the outcome of this study will show, and potentially it will be positive. So we're eager to see the results of this study as well. So let's go back to our case one. As we described, enasitinib was started and her white count continued to increase while on this therapy for the first week. Hydrea was initiated along with enasitinib, and this controlled her white count to less than 20,000, and she remained on therapy for a duration of 9 months and gained transfusion independence by cycle three. Unfortunately, she had progression of disease by 10 months, whereupon a new FLT3 mutation was detected, and she enrolled on a clinical trial as her next therapy. So to conclude, I would like to leave you with these key takeaway points. IDH2 mutations occur in about 8 to 19% of AML patients. Inhibition with enasitinib 100 milligrams by mouth daily is a reasonable outpatient option for relapsed or refractory AML patients with positive IDH2 mutation. Be mindful of toxicities, including differentiation syndrome, increased white blood cell count, and a rise in the total bilirubin, and know how to manage these, or at least know how to figure out what to do for these expected side effects in some of the population. Stable disease may be meaningful in this population, and we need to keep patients on therapy to at least cycle four months of therapy in order to determine their response to the therapy. And as we discussed, clinical trials are ongoing to evaluate combination therapy with hypomethylators and or induction chemotherapy to aid in improving upfront outcomes for our patients with AML. Obviously, we're aware of toxicity profiles and drug-drug interactions in that setting, and we need to be mindful of whether or not we should be doing overlapping or sequential therapy in the delivery of those combinations. I wanted to thank you for viewing this activity. And also thank the Taussig Cancer Center and the Cleveland Clinic and the faculty on the leukemia program that helped us work as a team to deliver care to our patients affected by myeloid disorders. The research nurses, our Taussig nurses, our data managers, and our lab research staff really help us to do what we do every day, and we're grateful to do it. Thank you for being here today. I appreciate it.